Another mass grave is found in northern Gaza containing some 30 blindfolded and bound bodies as the Israeli genocide in Gaza rages on. The United Nations warns of humanitarian collapse in the Gaza Strip after Western donors cut funding for UNRWA. And the Yemeni army says it's attacked an American merchant ship with naval missiles in retaliation for United States strikes on the Arab country. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. Another crime by Israeli occupation forces in Gaza, a mass grave of 30 civilians has been found in northern part of the besieged enclave. Palestinian officials have rebuked Israeli forces for carrying out field executions. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates says bodies were blindfolded and hands bound. Ministry called for the formation of an international field investigation team to probe Israel's genocide as well as the condition of missing or detained Palestinians. The discovery comes a day after 100 Palestinian bodies exhumed and stolen by Israeli regime forces from various areas of Gaza were returned. According to medical sources, though, the occupation army had stolen some organs from some of the bodies. The Palestinian Red Crescent in Gaza says Israeli forces have stormed Al Amal Hospital in the southern part of the besieged enclave in the city of Khan Yunis, where displaced people were seeking shelter. Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli forces demanded people inside the hospital evacuate at gunpoint, saying one civilian was killed after troops besieged the complex. Hamas has called the attack a new act of massacre and war crime committed by Israel. Separately, regime's airstrikes hit a residential building in the central city of Deir al-Balah, killing at least 11 people there, including several children. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says the death toll has reached 26,900 since the war began back on the 7th of October. Most of the killed have been women and children. Nearly 66,000 Palestinians have also been injured. Correspondent in central Gaza, Muti Abu Musab, explains how Israeli spy drones are surveilling Palestinians.
This sounded the sound of the Israeli fighter drones, and they are buzzing all the day over the heads of the Palestinian resistance, and it has become a matter of fact for the Palestinian people that whenever there is any kind of this, having these Israeli fighter drones flying on such low heights and distances, this means that the Israeli occupation forces are going to carry out more strikes and more attacks on that area. So apparently there are yet more massacres to be committed by the Israeli occupation forces, and apparently clearly, and you can hear clearly how annoying the voice is. We are talking in the same context, by the way, that the Israeli occupation forces all the time striking the several areas and several parts of Gaza Strip, and we can say that the Israeli bombardments hitting all areas of Gaza Strip simultaneously. These moments, as we speak right now, that even Khan Yunis city and Rafah city, four Palestinian civilians have just been killed by the Israeli occupation forces in Miraj area after the Israeli fighter drones targeted their car, their civilian car, as they were moving in the street.
The United Nations warns that defunding the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees risks a catastrophic humanitarian collapse in Gaza.
If the countries that suspended their funding to UNRWA maintain their decision, the impact will be catastrophic on the people of Gaza right now as the war continues.
15 countries, including major donors such as the U.S., Germany, Britain, and Sweden, suspended funding to UNRWA over accusations that several of its staff members were involved in the Hamas October 7th operation. UNRWA, though, rejects the accusation, saying it is extremely important to have an independent investigation into specific individual cases that Israel has raised.
In the case of our staff in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and in Gaza, we share the names of all our staff once a year with the Israeli government. We do something similar in all the host countries where we work. So we do share the name of our staff with the governments of Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, because we want to know if there are concerns from these governments. So we will continue doing this, and we will continue to take very seriously any allegation of breach of professionalism by our staff.
Norway, now one of the few major donors, also urged fellow donor countries to reflect on the wider consequences of cutting UNRWA funding. People in Gaza are already suffering from lack of food, water, and basic necessities. The WHO official also denounced the suspension of the aid to UNRWA, saying the population of Gaza is already starving to death due to constraints imposed on humanitarian aid.
This is a population that is starving to death. This is a population that is being pushed to the brink. And they are not parties to this conflict. And that is at the core of this. They are not parties to this conflict. The civilians of Gaza are not parties to this conflict. And they should be protected, as should be their health facilities. That is our only interest in this. And I believe that the international community need to reset our expectations in this response and reset the behavior of all parties in this conflict.
And I welcome everyone to News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. The Yemeni army says it's carried out another operation targeting an American vessel in waters near the country following a string of similar attacks in recent weeks. Yemen's army spokesperson Yahya Asari said merchant ship was hit with naval missiles as it was heading for occupied Palestinian territories. He added the operation was carried out hours after Yemeni naval forces targeted an American destroyer, the USS Gravely, in the Red Sea with several naval missiles. A spokesperson said the operation was in response to recent strikes by the U.S. and U.K. against Yemen. General Sari noted the country's armed forces will not hesitate to carry out further operations in retaliation for any act of what he called foolishness. He reiterated that all American and British ships in the Red and Arabian Seas are legitimate targets as long as aggression against Yemen persists. Sorry, added operations targeting Israel-related ships will continue until regime's aggression on and siege of the besieged Gaza Strip ends. And now joining us for our news review program is Abdulatif Al-Washali from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and Sundal Salasad, journalist and commentator, joining us out of the city of Beirut. Hello to both of you. Welcome to the program. Abdulatif, we're going to start with you. Good evening. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Sana'a. Tell us all you can, bud, about these anti-Israel operations, which have now expanded to anti-US and anti-UK operations.
Thank you so much. Since the first day of the aggression of the UK and US aggression against Yemen, the Yemeni army has made it clear that they will target any ship or vessel that is linked to not only Israel, but also to the UK and the US. And, you know, today the Yemeni army conducted two operations within hours, and this is a proof to the UK and to the US and also to the international community that the UK and US aggression against Yemen, against Yemeni territories, against the Yemeni army has failed to undermine the capabilities of the Yemeni army and to stop the Yemeni army's operations in the Red Sea and also in the Gulf of Aden. The Yemeni army will absolutely keep targeting the American and British ships and also the Israeli-linked ships. The ship was heading towards the occupied ports in Palestine. The Yemeni army will absolutely keep targeting those ships until they stop the war. Even if they stop the aggression against Yemen, the Yemeni army will continue its operations until the siege that is imposed against our brothers in Palestine is ended, and also the genocidal war that is being carried out by Israel is stopped. The Israelis, they love to see the Yemenis as only just proxies for Iran, but the truth is absolutely different, and it is much more complicated. Yemenis has their own independent interests, and they know what to do. They're not following any orders from any party. So if they keep just assaulting the Yemenis and only and also targeting the Yemenis, the Yemeni army will absolutely keep targeting the ships in the Red Sea and also in the Gulf of Aden.
Thank you, Abdulatif. And Sundus Al-Assad, welcome to the program. Now, Sundus, before the U.S. and U.K. got involved, there were over two dozen Israeli related, now whether they're headed to occupied Palestine or leaving from it, that were targeted by Yemeni armed forces. There were no fatalities. These were goods being intercepted and denied to go and dock in occupied Palestine in support of Gazans. But then the U.S. gets involved, the U.K. gets involved. They kill 11 Yemenis on the small boats there in the Red Sea. Then they also killed more Yemenis when they hit multiple cities about 10 days ago. Your thoughts on the fact that the U.S. and U.K. have had a really heavy-handed response? I mean, they're willing to kill Yemenis to protect goods, but they're not willing to protect the women and children of Gaza.
Yes, first of all, we have to remind every one of us that this war has been launched since the very beginning, has been supported and sponsored by Biden and the U.S. administration. And the U.S. has given the green light for the Zionist regime in order to shed the blood of the Palestinian babies, the Palestinian women, the Palestinian civilians. So what the Yemenis have been doing and are doing currently is a legitimate and righteous action against this genocide and the war crimes that are being committed against our Palestinian brothers in Gaza. The same is being done by the Lebanese resistance of Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance and the other resistance faction. So that's totally legitimate, and this is the direct message for the both the British and the American administration and the entire Western governments that are supporting this genocide that is being committed in Gaza, that you can't undermine the power of the resistance, and it's our duty to stand in solidarity and to support the Palestinian innocents and the Palestinian people who are being ethnically cleansed without any action from the so-called international community that ought to be helping and protecting the civilians. But on the contrary, we have seen that they have kept silent and turned deaf ears and blind eyes with the support that is being granted for this colonial apartheid regime occupying the Palestinian lands.
Thank you both for joining us. Stay safe to both of you. Abdul Latif Al-Washali joining us from Sana'a, and Sonos Al-Assad joining us from Beirut, Lebanon. So that brings us to the end of this conclusion, or this segment of your news program. Thank you, news review program, pardon. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now. Israeli forces disguised as women and medics attacked a hospital in the occupied West Bank on Tuesday, killing three Palestinians while they were asleep in their beds. During a briefing, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby was grilled and left with no clear answers regarding this incident.
Okay, and then my second thing, which has to do with this operation that the Israelis launched in Jenin, a hospital mm-hmm. today. What do you have any comment on that? Is this something that you think is problematic?
Israel, of course, has the right to carry out operations to bring terrorists to justice, but those operations need to be conducted in full compliance with international humanitarian law.
Well, those operations include going into hospitals and murdering people in their beds, regardless of whether they are suspected or
so. You don't think killed people
who were completely innocent?
So let me say that
if you did think that, then you would be condemning it, right?
We certainly would. We would generally say that we don't want them to carry out operations in hospitals, but under international humanitarian law, hospitals do lose some of their protections if they are being used to for the planning of terrorist operations.
I mean, going in disguised as, you know, women and doctors and whatever is something different. And then going in and picking out people in particular rooms and particular beds and killing them seems to be something different.
On this particular one, I mean, Israel occupies the whole West Bank. They are under their control.
They don't need to disguise themselves as medics and go into a hospital and kill people, which he called non-civilian. They are actually civilians, but that's beside the point.
So that is very much. But hold on.
There are civilian members of Hamas. It's a political organization. I mean, you may disagree with their politics, but that does not make them militant.
I would very much disagree with that. They're a terrorist organization, right, as have been designated by the United States
of
America.
But that's an accusation of the occupier, a military occupier. They are making the accusation. I want to ask you, is that a conduct befitting a state or a group of gangsters to go in and kill people, assassinate them as they sat in there?
So we think it is appropriate that they have the ability to bring members of Hamas to justice.
Tensions are high across the southern Lebanese border over Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. In the latest development, Hezbollah resistance fighters performed a number of operations against Israeli military vehicles and troops. Our correspondent in Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, has her details.
Hezbollah has been very specific on saying what they targeted, who they targeted, and in three different posts, actually, they said that they targeted Israeli soldiers. And it seems that they are able to get accurate intelligence to the extent that they know, for example, that these soldiers are situated near the post or inside the barracks. In one instance, for example, today in their operation in the settlement of Motile, they said that they targeted a building where they knew there were a group of soldiers that were situated inside this building, and they said that they hit and struck their target very precisely. They also targeted groups of soldiers near the barracks of Meitat. They said that they were close to the barracks, not inside the barracks itself. And also in Bayad Blida, they said that they targeted a group of soldiers. And so it seems that Hezbollah has been, in most of their statements, stressing that when they do target soldiers, they are also very adamant on stressing that and making sure that they have put that forward. And that if the Israelis, of course, talk about the issue of casualties, basically minimizing the number of casualties, that would definitely not be accurate. Now, in addition to those, they also targeted a Merkava tank in Hanita, I believe. And there were also another example of targeting espionage devices, as they have been doing in the last week.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The turn of events in recent months amid the Zionist regime genocidal war on the Gaza Strip has demonstrated to the world the awe-inspiring bravery and heroism of the Yemeni government and its military. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV wrote, "Identity from a political perspective refers to self-awareness in the mirror of interaction with others. This identity enables the basic political distinction between friends and enemies. According to this interpretation, political actors shape their foreign policy based on the friend-enemy dimension. First, we need to discuss the revolutionary nature of Iran. The fall of the Pahlavi regime in Iran, which had been in power from 1925 until 1979, and the subsequent victory and establishment of the Islamic Republic, marked the success of a revolutionary ideology vital for understanding the significance of the anti-colonial and anti-hegemonic vision upon which Iran bases its foreign policy. Due to this revolutionary ideology, resistance against those powers deemed hegemonic is considered a political military obligation. Another fundamental element to understanding the identity of the Islamic Republic is the Islamic dimension, which is the main element upon which the revolutionary ideology is based. It includes embracing the idea of Muslim unity propounded by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, and bringing the gap between Sunni and Shia. It includes embracing the idea of Muslim unity propounded by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, and bridging the gap between Sunni and Shia. In other words, the goal is to assert that Islam is a common language that enables Muslims to interact and debate among themselves. Another element is building a just society, which is an ethical political aspiration that lies at the heart of the Islamic ideology. It calls on Muslims to tirelessly struggle against oppression in all its forms. From the Islamic political perspective expressed by the Islamic Republic of Iran, it sees the world as a confrontation between justice and oppression. When defining the main factors that articulate the identity of Ansarullah, it is necessary to analyze the widespread idea that treats the group in a particular way and Yemen in a general sense as a tribal society based on ethnic diversity and without a national identity. This type of analysis assumes that the nation-state is a privileged element when defining and identifying political identities. From this kind of reductionism, it is not possible to understand either the Iranian Islamic identity or the political affinities between Ansarullah and the Islamic Republic. That being said, for Ansarullah, one of its historical identities is what the group refers to as an Arab identity. This identity, in turn, is mediated by Islamist discourse, a political discourse that allows for various articulations. It is precisely this Islamist discourse that explains the convergence between Iran and Ansarullah. The Yemeni group sees Islam as a discourse of liberation against colonial oppression, both internal and external, as well as against the presence of countries considered oppressors and aliens in the region. This political convergence highlights the inadequacy of explanations that seek to portray the collaboration between Tehran and Sana'a solely in terms of Shia religious affiliations. This essentialist reductionism fails to consider the political dimensions of Islam, understood as discourse. The political affinity between Ansarullah resistance movement and Iran becomes even more apparent when considering the revolutionary ideology of the Yemeni group. Since its origins in 1990s, the group has embraced the doctrine of velayat-e-faqih, or the system introduced by Imam Khomeini, and its cornerstone of the current Islamic Republic as a political ethical guide for its actions in the political arena. In the post-9/11 era and the so-called War on Terror by the US regime, Ansarullah publicly expressed its anti-imperialism. Simultaneously, leaders of Ansarullah, such as Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, further aligned ideologically with the Islamic Republic of Iran. In a speech in 2001, during the commemoration of Al-Quds Day, an annual event established by Imam Khomeini for the liberation of Quds, Houthi emphasized the path of resistance against oppression and identified the United States regime as the main enemy of the Yemeni people. In 2002, Al-Houthi himself introduced what has since become the group's slogan, "God is great, death to America, death to Israel, curse upon the Jews, victory for Islam." This slogan shares a discursive affinity with one of the most widely used slogans in Iran, "Marg bar America," translated as "death to America," actually meaning the American hegemony. Hence, it can be seen how Iran and Ansarullah express, in a shared Islamic tradition, the rejection of the naturalization of the presence of oppressive foreign forces in the region. Iranian officials have repeatedly asserted that the Yemeni government's actions in the Red Sea are not dictated by Tehran. It's a sovereign country that makes its own decisions.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us reflect on one of the wise sayings of the most virtuous lady of all times, the Holy Prophet's Immaculate Daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Allah made all the beings without previous matter, design, shape and pattern, and made them wear the dress of life and created them according to His divine will and intention, without any need for their creation or any benefit for Himself, except that He desired to give a proof of His wisdom.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what is backbiting and what is not. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the actions severely prohibited in Islam is backbiting. Backbiting is to narrate and display a deficiency or the negative action of a believer. Precisely speaking, if you were to ask what would be the definition of backbiting, I would say backbiting is to narrate and display a deficiency or the negative action of a believing person which he would not like to be disclosed. This last part is very important. If you know of a believer that has a deficiency and he doesn't like that deficiency to be disclosed to others, and you go around his back and, you know, reveal that deficiency to others. Or even worse, he's present there on his face, you reveal that deficiency to others. This is called backbiting. And what is not a backbiting is very important to understand as well. To disclose something which is evident, which the doer himself does not hide, it is not forbidden. If an oppressed person narrates about the oppressive actions of his oppressor, well, that's totally fine, and as a matter of fact, good. If someone speaks about a person who has made an innovation in religion, again, it is not forbidden, and in some cases, it becomes wajib to expose that alteration of the religion of Allah. And then there are other instances where narrating the negative qualities of someone is not forbidden and they are discussed in the books of Islamic law. Now, the question is listening to backbiting also forbidden? Let's discuss that after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of what is backbiting and what is not. So the question we raised right before the break was, is listening to backbiting also forbidden in Islam, or is it just the backbiting discouraged and forbidden in Islam? Well, listening to backbiting is also forbidden, and the listener should defend the victim. So if you're in a setting where there's backbiting done of another believer, then Islam expects you to step in and defend that believer who may not be present there, or in some cases may be present there but does not like this trait of his or this quality or this deficiency of his to be discussed. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, O you who believe, avoid most of suspicion, for surely suspicion in some cases is a sin. And do not spy, nor let some of you backbite others. Does one of you like to eat the flesh of his dead brother? Verily you abhor it. And be careful of your duty to Allah. Surely Allah is oft returning to mercy, merciful. Suspicion not only causes discomfort and forms an environment of mistrust in the society, instead, it can potentially amount to being a sin. Similarly, spying on other believers, is not allowed in Islam, generally speaking. Quran, the Holy Quran, has referred backbiting of a believer to be equivalent of eating the flesh of one's dead brother. This is how Islam portrays this trait or this habit or this negative quality for a believer. We're not supposed to be backbiting other believers at any cost.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will go over the blows the occupation army received in the Gaza Strip and the doubts spreading within the Zionist community about achieving the goals of the aggression. We will also talk about the absence of an effective strategy in Gaza or in southern Lebanon after Hezbollah was able to establish what the Hebrew media called a security belt inside the occupied Palestinian territories. Regarding these issues, I welcome Professor Hadi Khobaesi, director of the Union Center for Research and Development, with a warm welcome to you, dear Professor. Now let us begin with the specific raid operation in the middle of the Gaza Strip, which is still a hot topic in the Hebrew media and within the Zionist community, and with words that came from the father of one of the officers who was killed in this operation, in which he described the leadership of the occupation army as stupid. This raid operation also affected the families of the dead officers and soldiers, including a brother of one of them. Israeli social media was filled with the comments of the Al-Magesi incident, holding the occupation leaders responsible for the killing of the Zionist soldiers and officers there.
Avirnab.
The chief of staff is stupid.
Ravital.
The war is going on as if it were the first year of the chief of staff.
Sarit.
I have always believed that the army is strong and the Jewish people are smart. It becomes clear to me every day that we are surrounded by fools.
Yali.
It seems to me that all our soldiers will be killed.
Dovdov.
Would it not eliminate Hamas and it not liberate the captives? This is a disdain for the soldiers.
Professor Hadi Khobaesi, to what extent can the leadership of the occupation army be described as stupid? And why is the confidence of the Zionist community declining, as we have seen on Israeli social media? This decline is also seen in the army's ability with its plan of aggression against the Gaza Strip.
We made many analyses about what happened on October 7th in the army headquarters in Al-Kiryah and in the areas surrounding the Gaza Strip. It was clear that there was a great shock, and the rush that occurred in taking Al-Gharawat was influenced by this shock. They wanted to restore the deterrence, prestige, and dignity of their army. It needed this. With experience, it has been shown that this decision, which was taken under pressure and was taken under shock, does not have the expected result or does not have a clear impact. Over time, it became clear how wrong this decision, which was made at the beginning, was. Biden referred to the experiences the U.S. government had in Iraq, Somalia, and Afghanistan, and said there may be a very distant success. Now it is being gradually revealed for society, and they are discovering the failure that has occurred following their so-called strategic decision. Expressing sentiments about inevitable victory for repeating such fake promises every day to motivate the society and the army to continue the war did not work anymore. Especially by Netanyahu and his team, who should bear the responsibility for what happened on October 7th. They said they were going in for a decisive victory, but things didn't work out as they thought. With time, these expectations and hopes decline, and we saw that within a week and 10 days, all the experts, commentators, and writers say that we have reached a point where there is uncertainty about the results. The other day, Amos Yadlin, who was a general in the Israeli Air Force, made an important speech. He said that the residents of the settlements in the area around the Gaza Strip must return because there are no longer risks to them. There are some voices that are trying to contain the situation and alleviate the crisis and are trying to solve the problem without continuing the war until the end, because the costs of continuing the war until the end are increasing. and it is increasing the number of deaths, pressure on the economy, international pressure. And now we have the decision of the International Court of Justice, and they are also trying to find a way out of this impasse.
As a result, Mr. Hadi Kobayashi, an army was established, and for this army, a regime was established. And now the Zionists in this regime doubt this army. How do you analyze this?
The army has been operating for many years, meaning from 1982 until now, meaning approximately more than 41 years, and it has not fought a large war. It needs new experiences, so they came to the experiment to see if they could succeed, but the experiment happened under pressure, without a clear plan. They discovered later that their intel about Gaza is not enough. Their intelligence system proved to be weak. The tunnels are a nightmare. Field operational information also does not provide results.
The resistance seems to know the tactics of the Israeli army.
The resistance is adapting, meaning it is learning from city to city, seeing how the enemy plans and how it operates. Also, the resistance has high flexibility in the field, as we see it is operating in Khan Yunis. The leadership is there, but we do not know where.
However, there's no real strategy in this battle that the occupation army is waging in the Gaza Strip. The question is, how long can the reserve soldiers bear with the losses they're incurring in terms of their lives and their economy? The absence of a practical strategy in this aggression against Gaza will inevitably lead to failure to achieve the two declared goals, which are liquidating the resistance and releasing the captives by force. The failure of this aggression on Gaza and the failure to achieve the declared goals prompted opposition leader Yair Lapid to admit that what he once called the superpower had received a blow from a resistance organization. So, Professor Hadi Kobayashi, while there is no clear strategy in this aggression against the Gaza Strip, how do you appreciate Lapid's description of the reality about their military failure in Gaza, saying that a superpower had received a blow from a resistance organization?
First, with regard to this strategy, it is based on two basic points: political legitimacy and capabilities and materials. In the past, there was always a problem that Israel has occupied a land that does not belong to it, and therefore this people are ready to fight for a long time. This is the problem of legitimacy. Capabilities have now changed, meaning that now they have no possibility to dry up capabilities or eliminate capabilities. Hamas, as a result of the presence of the tunnels, as a result of the smart, long, and careful preparation over many years for this war, has managed to adjust its resources and capabilities at the level of legitimacy. The people of the Gaza Strip want their land, and they are with the resistance and continue to support the resistance. Thus, the strategy, meaning basic capabilities and basic components, is missing at the tactical and operational levels as well. The resistance, as we said a while ago, is adapting, learning, and benefiting. It has gained a lot of experience in the past 3 months from the war. Previously, the Israelis were missing out on open areas. Today, they have open areas, obstacles, ambushes, and new methods of operation, even open areas. The resistance is back to work even in the areas that the enemy has destroyed, so there is a problem with continuity and reaching the goal. The areas that the enemy considers it is done with and destroyed and eliminated, what it calls the bridge capabilities, meaning the leadership and establishments, are back to work. The enemy also pointed out, and I expected it 2 months ago, that the youth of the Gaza Strip, who here have the ability to carry weapons, whom here do not have a job and have a very great motivation to defend, are joining Hamas. An Israeli commentator said that there is continuous enrollment in Hamas.
This confirms what the opposition leader Yair Lapid said in this context, that a superpower received a blow today from a resistance organization.
Of course, they were subjected to a very important strategic diversionary operation recorded in history. I mean, what Hamas did was very smart, and there was great confidence in it that it will succeed. What is more important than planning is that it has confidence in success, certainty in continuity, and preparation for the reaction as well. The enemy was not expecting that things would turn out like this. There is something in them that has a certain flaw. As we can see, all their previous statements talk about the threat to existence. 80 years have passed since the development of the Axis of Resistance and its missiles, but still Israel is not appreciating its enemy's capabilities. There is still disrespect, lack of appreciation, or belittlement.
It is clear that Israel's deterrence power has eroded, and there is no possibility of concluding this battle, neither in the Gaza Strip or even in southern Lebanon. And the coming days will be worse, according to one of the reserve generals in the occupation army. So we see that the occupation army is undergoing the worst erosion of its deterrence powers. We used to hear this from the Zionists before the Operation Al-Aqsa, and this confession is still on their lips today after the aggression. How will this be resolved? What does this confusion mean?
Of course, they always expected that one day the resistance axis would attack them, uniting the arenas, changing the balance of power and the permanent development that is working on the axis. We're now seeing the first stage of this uprising, and for these reasons, it was not clear to them how they would confront this operation of multiple arenas and multiple arms. They were counting on the United States of America, frankly, for something. Here is also an important factor other than the balance of power, which is the shock they received because of it. Of course, it is very important because they have become internally weakened and have lost vision and faith. According to what was leaked to the media, Netanyahu called Biden and said on the phone that if you do not come with your forces, you will wake up in the morning and you will not find Israel. This shock made the entire regime to think twice before making any move. For example, when it thinks about Lebanon, it imagines October 7th. When it thinks about Syria, that's the same. They always remember this shock. It is true that this shock gives them an incentive to work and also an impulse to aggression against Lebanon or Syria and others, but it also makes Israel think that, yes, I am heading towards a war, but I may receive an unexpected response too, and there may be consequences and surprises. Israel has become suspicious about the capabilities of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Also, Ben David said some time ago that we discovered that the capabilities are due to God's will, not ours to begin with.
As for southern Lebanon, the area that extends to the northern settlements near the border with southern Lebanon has enabled Hezbollah to impose what the Hebrew media called the security belt. The southern Lebanon front has inflicted a heavy impact on the settlers in the occupied Palestinian north and on their economy and livelihood, as 90% of them are experiencing economic damage as a result of Hezbollah strikes. Professor Hadi Kubayesi, it seems that the calamity of the South Lebanon front is very heavy on the settlers and their economy. To what extent does this represent pressure on the Zionist occupation regime and army?
We used to say that the war in Gaza is to liberate the Gaza Strip. I mean, after the operation on October 7th, the settlers living in the envelope emigrated. About 500,000 Israelis are trying to regain that area. Also in the Galilee, there are signs of Palestine liberation, but for a temporary period. I mean, we saw that the resistance entered the Gaza Strip for 3 days, but until now, the envelope is still unviable in the south, too. There are limited operations, but the strategic impact of these operations is very broad and very large that we can see this effect on the return of the settlers or the perspective of this achievement. Israel has diminished. This is what we were talking about. Israel is now in need of a war to liberate the Galilee, even if it is not a large-scale war, because achieving security in the Galilee requires a different step, an adjustment in the balance of power, or a war that requires a new approach. They have now lost part of the land, and there we are at the first stage of the liberation of Palestine, an experiment or rehearsal, so to speak, which is taking place in the Gaza envelope or the Galilee. Exiting this stage for the Israelis is very costly. Either the settlers do not agree to live in the place from which they may be displaced later and may be exposed to another calamity such as October 7th, or they should acquiesce to a war that will displace them or destroy their settlements. Returning to the Galilee will take years. If they enter into a war with Lebanon, the return will take years. If they return after this war and say, we're ready to stay in an unsafe area, they will also have a different condition. staying with a view to continuity in this land, searching for alternatives and preparing these alternatives in the future. I mean, the outside world will have a different situation.
No. It seems that the state of anxiety is expanding day after day in light of this missile, which we must comment on. Hezbollah targeted an intelligence facility site at Jalal Alam in southern Lebanon.
The process is simple.
And there's a camera, too.
But the importance of this process is the movement of the missile. This missile can cross over hills and valleys and target sensitive areas. We do not know how many ranges, because the ranges of these missiles used to be 10 kilometers, but there are also missiles with a range of 10 to 12 kilometers. This enables the resistance to carry out very important operations. And I'm not here to talk about options or possibilities. However, targeting sensitive points within the 10-kilometer line without having a direct view is an achievement. We see that the Meron base directly targets a high mountain with direct camera supervision over it, but not in the back areas, places inside the barracks in all fortified areas.
And then in surprise,
these are accessible with high precision and direct camera supervision.
And about the threats of the occupation leaders to expand the war with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which is the focus of discussion amongst the Americans. They're still proposing a comprehensive war that would affect Lebanon and state institutions, as former head of the Zionist Security Council, Gure Elan, said. Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, what is the nature of what Gure Elan talked about the negotiations between the Americans and the Zionists regarding the future of Lebanon and the details that were given to him?
I agree that they have a flaw in the way of thinking after the shock and after the crisis, because if they do not neutralize the civilians, they will not neutralize Beirut. All of the civilian infrastructure in northern Israel will be exposed to the attacks. We already know that the Iron Dome was struck twice, meaning that this dome can be targeted. And these are experiments for strong attack in the north. Most of these missiles have no deterrent. They're huge missiles and smart. Thousands of them rain down on all civil structures, electricity, factories, official institutions. I do not know how they think. They are devoid of logic if they do not even see Gallant's repeated volatile, airy statements. They have numerous problems, but the main one is the shock they received on October 7th. Israel is left without options and is being deceived by the resistance. Every day we have news that they are making maneuvers and are preparing. The other day, they informed the travelers in Israel that they had seized motors and satellite phones, and they asked the residents of the north to come and make supplies. Also, during the past 2 weeks, they have been doing a lot of work, but practically there is nothing realistic to find. They are running out of options. They are turning to these solutions, and by eliminating options, they are thinking in a way that is not in their interest.
Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, please comment briefly.
The issue of the captives is growing in terms of influence, but its impact is limited. The main factor is the failure to achieve the goals because the Israelis are ready to make sacrifices. Society said, we give you sacrifices, we give you time, but give us the result of the basic influential factor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your follow-up. Until we meet again, God willing.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In a blatant move, U.S. Representative Nancy Pelosi has said the FBI should investigate groups that are speaking out about Biden's pro-Israel policies. Pelosi has also called for FBI to investigate Gaza ceasefire supporters. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, as the New York Times reported recently, that more than 1,000 Black American pastors have joined the widespread call for a ceasefire in Gaza, U.S. Representative Nancy Pelosi said the FBI should investigate groups that are speaking out about Biden's pro-Israel policies. On CNN, the former House Speaker, a California Democrat, told Dana Bash that the call for a ceasefire is a message and said she thinks some of the protests that have erupted across the U.S. since October to demand the U.S. push for an end to Israel's killing of civilians in Gaza are connected to Russia. Pelosi claimed, "I think some financing should be investigated and I want to ask the FBI to investigate that." A number of progressives pointed out that the demand for a ceasefire is hardly coming from the fringes of American society, but rather from more than two-thirds of Americans in a November poll by Reuters Ipsos. Three-quarters of Democrats in the survey backed a ceasefire along with half of Republicans. The Times detailed calls for more than 1,000 Black pastors who represent hundreds of thousands of congregants across the U.S. and who have written open letters and spoken to White House officials at sit-down meetings in support of a ceasefire, warning that it's going to be very hard to persuade our people to go back to the polls and vote for Biden. The Intercept reporter Prem Thakur pointed to other groups supportive of the call, including the Democratic parties of Arizona and Texas, the United Auto Workers, which endorsed Biden recently, and Doctors Without Borders. Writer and researcher Abdullah Shipar denounced Pelosi's comments as stupid, but was among those who cautioned against dismissing her plan to ask the FBI to investigate certain pro-Palestinian rights protesters and groups. He said, "She's calling for effectively more surveillance and potential criminalization of protesters by suggesting falsely that they have foreign links." Pelosi's serious and dangerous policy suggestion, added journalist Jeet here, echoes Nixon LBJ abuse of law enforcement. Nihad Awad, executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, said the group was deeply disturbed by Pelosi's downright authoritarian comments. He said, "Sadly, Representative Pelosi's comments echo a time in our nation when opponents of the Vietnam War were accused of being communist sympathizers and subjected to FBI harassment." He added, "Hundreds of thousands of Americans, including many young people, progressive activists, and Jewish, Muslim, Palestinian, and Black Americans